Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. Imagine for a moment a chunk of DNA that just acts completely selfishly.
Right.
Like it constantly duplicates itself, tearing through the genome and causing this severe genetic instability. We're talking about duplications that are a major cause of recurrent microdeletion and microduplication syndromes, which are conditions directly linked to things like autism, schizophrenia, developmental delay, and severe obesity.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a catastrophic error in our biological code.
Right.
From a classical genetic standpoint, you know, a glitch that causes that level of disease burden, it should just be ruthlessly edited out by natural selection over time. It really shouldn't survive across generations.
Right. But here is the profound biological paradox we are exploring in this deep dive. What really happens when a piece of DNA causes so much genetic damage, yet our evolutionary history strongly favors it? Like, why would human evolution actively select for a genetic feature that predisposes us to such severe life-altering diseases?
It is genuinely one of the most fascinating questions in modern genetics. We are basically looking at an evolutionary trade-off on a massive scale.
Yeah.
Because the mathematical reality of natural selection dictates that the benefits of this unstable DNA, they have to be so extraordinary that they actively outweigh the devastating risks.
Wow. Well, before we get into the mechanics of this mystery and, you know, unpack how that math could possibly make sense, we need to acknowledge the people who actually cracked the code. Today, we celebrate the work of Philip C. Dyshuk, Evan E. Eichler, and their team, who have advanced our understanding of extreme structural variation in the human genome.
And honestly, their work represents a monumental technical achievement. To really appreciate why this team's research is so groundbreaking for you listening, you have to understand the historical wall that scientists hit when trying to study this specific region of our DNA.
So the subject of our deep dive today is the NPIP gene family, which historically was also known by a rather ominous name.
Yeah, Morpheus.
Right, Morpheus. And it sits primarily on the short arm of chromosome 16, a region known to geneticists as 16p, nestled within this core repeating unit of DNA called LCR16A.
Exactly. And the sheer scale of the expansion of this gene family is what initially like catches your attention, especially when you compare it across different primate species.
Oh, right. The macaque comparison.
Yeah. If you sequence the genome of a macaque monkey, you will find exactly one single copy of this gene. Just one. But in humans, we have experienced this completely unprecedented expansion. Depending on the individual, humans have anywhere from 21 to 33 copies per haploid genome.
Which is wild. Mm-hmm. And just to clarify, for anyone catching up on the terminology, you know, a haploid genome refers to just one single set of chromosomes, like the single set you inherit from one parent.
Right.
So if we have 20 to 30 copies on just one set, we're talking about an enormous amount of genetic real estate dedicated to this one single gene. And the research notes that the highest copy numbers are observed in individuals of African descent, which obviously tracks with the deep evolutionary roots of our species.
It does. But, you know, having dozens of copies of the exact same gene isn't just a quirk of human biology. It's a massive clinical problem.
Because it makes the chromosome unstable.
Right.
Right. But I want to stop you there for a second because unstable is a word we throw around a lot in these discussions.
Yeah.
How does merely having extra copies of a gene physically break a chromosome?
Well, it really comes down to how cells divide. During meiosis, which is the process of creating sperm or egg cells, your chromosomes have to line up and physically pair off with their corresponding partner.
Okay.
And they use DNA sequence similarity to find the right match. But when you have dozens of nearly identical DNA segments scattered all across the arm of chromosome 16, the biological machinery just gets completely confused. It lines up the wrong copies.
So it's essentially misaligning the genetic zipper.
That is a great way to picture it, actually. When the zipper is misaligned, the chromosome eventually undergoes what we call non-allelic homologous recombination, or NAHR.
Right.
Basically, the DNA breaks and recombines in the wrong spot. As a result, large chunks of DNA between those mismatched copies get deleted entirely, or they get duplicated again. This mechanical failure during cell division is exactly what mediates the neurodevelopmental diseases we mentioned earlier.
But wait, if this region is causing such a severe structural breakdown, why hasn't science mapped this out perfectly before now? I mean, we mapped the human genome decades ago.
Well, we mapped most of it, but this specific region was blocked by a pretty severe technical limitation. For two decades, the standard method for reading DNA was short read sequencing.
Oh, right. Short reads.
Yeah. You basically chop the genome up into millions of tiny short fragments, you read those fragments, and then you use a computer algorithm to stitch them back together based on where the sequences overlap.
We've used an analogy for this before. It's like trying to put together a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle where 100 of the pieces are just identical squares of blue sky.
Yes.
With short read sequencing, you just can't tell which blue sky piece goes in which spot.
Exactly. Because the NTIP duplicated segments share over 97% sequence identity, it was entirely impossible to map them accurately. The algorithms just couldn't figure out which nearly identical fragment belonged to which of the 30 copies.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so as a result, the reference genomes we've relied on for years, like GRC38, were actually misassembled in this region. They were creating chimeric genes, artificial sequences that didn't really exist in nature, simply because the computers were artificially collapsing different identical pieces of that blue sky together.
Okay, so if short read sequencing was practically blind to this region, what changed? How did this team suddenly map out something that defied standard sequencing for 20 years?
The breakthrough came from utilizing entirely new technology. The researchers used highly accurate long read sequencing assemblies.
Which is huge.
Massive. Thanks to recent consortium efforts, specifically the T2T, or Telomere to Telomere Consortium, the Human Pangenome Reference Consortium, and the Human Genome Structural Variation Consortium, we aren't stuck looking at tiny fragmented puzzle pieces anymore. The researchers were able to analyze massive, contiguous, unbroken stretches of DNA across 169 different human haplotypes.
So they essentially put on long read glasses. Mm-hmm. Instead of reading single words out of context, they could read whole pages of the genetic manual at once.
Right.
See exactly where each copy of NPIP was located without the algorithm collapsing them.
Exactly. And they didn't stop at just reading the static DNA. This is where the methodology becomes incredibly comprehensive. They also utilize transcriptomics, specifically a technology called PacBio IsoSec, which is long-read RNA sequencing.
Okay, so they're looking at cDNA.
Yeah.
For anyone unfamiliar, when researchers sequence cDNA or complementary DNA, they're basically creating a highly stable, lab-friendly copy of the RNA transcripts that the cell was actively producing at that exact moment.
Yeah, precisely.
It essentially shows you which genes are actually turned on.
That is the critical distinction. By analyzing the long-read RNA data, you see what the cell is physically doing with that DNA. The team analyzed a staggering 1.4 billion full-length cDNA reads from 101 different human tissues and cell types.
That's a massive data set.
It really is, and this allowed them to see exactly which of these nearly identical genetic copies were actually being read by the cellular machinery, and in which specific tissues of the body they were active.
Okay, so once the researchers combined these new long-read DNA maps with the RNA activity logs, what did they actually find? Because earlier you mentioned extreme structural variation, and I want to dig into what that actually looks like on a molecular level.
Right, so the first major finding is the sheer scale of structural variation occurring right now in human populations. These NPIP gene copies aren't just sitting statically in our genome. They are constantly overwriting each other through a mechanism called interlocus gene conversion, or IGC.
Wait, I want to make sure I understand the physical mechanics of this. How does one gene physically overwrite another gene that is sitting thousands of base pairs away on the chromosome?
Well, it happens during those moments when the chromosome is tightly coiled and looped around itself. Because these sequences are 97% identical, a loop can bring two different copies of the gene into direct physical contact.
So it's less like saving a document on a computer and more like,
yeah.
Two identical pages of a freshly printed book getting stuck together.
Yes.
When you try to pull them apart, the wet ink from one page rips off and sticks to the other, physically overwriting the text.
That perfectly captures the physical nature of the interaction. When the DNA repair proteins come in to fix the tangled strands, they use one copy as a template to repair the other, physically replacing the neighbor sequence with its own.
Wow.
Yeah, and this homogenizes the genes, keeping them nearly identical across the chromosome, which in turn drives even more instability. Alongside this IGC process, they discovered four massive inversion polymorphisms.
Inversion, meaning the DNA is literally flipped backward.
Yes. These are massive chunks of DNA, ranging from 350 kilobase pairs to 1.6 megabase pairs that have been excised, flipped 180 degrees, and stitched back into the chromosome. And these aren't rare anomalies, they are actively circulating in the general human population.
I'm trying to wrap my head around this. If these genes are constantly overwriting each other, and massive chunks of the chromosome are just flipping backward, how do we even know what's functional and what's just evolutionary junk? Mm-hmm. Didn't geneticists previously think a lot of these copies were just dead pseudogenes?
They absolutely did. And that actually brings us to the second and perhaps most shocking finding of this study.
Okay.
By looking at that long-read RNA data from the 101 different tissues, the researchers essentially resurrected these so-called pseudogenes. They found that 56% of the MPIP protein models discovered in this study had never been previously reported in scientific literature.
Wait, really? Over half of them were entirely unknown to science?
Yes, over half. Furthermore, four specific paralogs, which are the duplicated copies of the gene, specifically designated as B1, A4, B10, and B14, they were historically classified by geneticists as non-coding pseudogenes.
Right.
They were considered dead genetic code that had just accumulated too many mutations to function.
But the RNA data proved otherwise. How do you prove a gene isn't dead, though? I assume it has to do with finding an open reading frame.
That is exactly the definitive proof. An open reading frame means the gene possesses intact start and stop codons without any premature roadblocks. The ISO-seq data prove that not only do these four paralogs maintain open reading frames, but they actively produce full-length transcripts.
That is incredible.
Yeah, the cellular machinery is actively reading them from end to end and trying to build proteins from them.
That is wild. We have this massive, highly volatile genetic factory producing proteins we didn't even know existed. But what are these proteins actually doing? Does looking at the evolutionary timeline give us any clues about their function?
It gives us profound clues, actually. When the researchers compared our genome to other primates, they were able to map out an evolutionary timeline. Around 2.6 to 3.1 million years ago, which is a critical window specific to the early evolution of the human lineage, this NPIP gene family underwent intense diversification and evolved entirely new structural features.
Right, so 2.6 to 3.1 million years ago. That is exactly the time period when our ancestors, like the late Australopithecus and early Homo species, were undergoing massive transitions.
Zigzags.
They were committing to upright walking, and we see the beginnings of significant brain expansion.
Yeah.
What exactly did this chaotic region of DNA build during that window?
Well, they identified two major human-specific innovations. First, they found a novel signal peptide sequence that is highly expressed in the testes.
Okay.
A signal peptide acts like a biological shipping label on a newly synthesized protein. It tells the cell's transport machinery exactly where to send that protein.
The fact that this specific shipping label is highly active in the testes strongly suggests it plays a direct role in reproduction. Or perhaps sperm competition.
Right. Which, biologically speaking, is a classic battle game for evolutionary arms races. But what was the second innovation?
The second is an expanded variable number tandem repeat, or VNTR. This is a sequence of DNA that basically stutters, repeating the same short code over and over again. In the NPIP genes, this stutter actually encodes a specific physical protein structure called a beta helix, or a transmembrane domain.
Wait, I need to visualize that. How does a simple repeating stutter in the DNA sequence translate into a specific three-dimensional shape like a beta helix?
Because every time the DNA sequence repeats, it adds another block of specific amino acids to the resulting protein chain. Certain amino acids naturally want to coil up or form sheets due to their chemical properties.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so in this case, the specific repeating amino acids fold into a rigid helical structure that can anchor the protein into a cell membrane. And here is the crucial detail. Unlike the signal peptide we just discussed, this beta helix variant is highly expressed in the brain. So this highly volatile, fast-evolving gene family specifically created new protein structures aimed at the two most crucial organs for human evolutionary success: the brain for cognition and the reproductive system for passing those traits on.
It is a really profound realization, but the genetic innovation doesn't even stop there. The researchers also found fusion genes.
Fusion genes?
Yeah. They discovered instances where the NPIP gene physically merged with another entirely separate gene located nearby called PKD1.
I recognize that name. PKD1 is the gene primarily linked to polycystic kidney disease, right?
It is, yeah. Now, usually a random fusion between two complex genes would just create a broken, non-functional mess of amino acids.
Right.
But here, they found that these NPIP PPKD1 fusions create functional multi-exonic transcripts. The cell processes them flawlessly, creating hybrid proteins up to 843 amino acids long.
Wow.
It's essentially a massive novel protein whose biological function we haven't even begun to fully understand.
All of this structural reshuffling, these human-specific innovations in the brain and tests, these wild fusion proteins, it points directly back to the paradox we started with. Why is evolution driving this chaotic behavior?
To answer that mathematically, the researchers ran population selection tests, specifically calculating Tajima's D and NSL statistics across the genomes of different human populations.
Let's break those tests down for a second because they are crucial to understanding the evolutionary math here. How do Tajima's D and NSL actually prove that evolution is favoring a gene?
Well, they look for the genomic footprint of what we call a selective sweep. When a new genetic mutation is highly advantageous, individuals who have it survive and reproduce at much higher rates.
Okay.
So that specific gene sequence rapidly sweeps through the population, but it doesn't travel alone. As it gets passed down, it physically drags along the neighboring neutral DNA sequences that happen to sit next to it on the chromosome.
Like a genetic hitchhiker.
Yes, exactly like a hitchhiker. Because this entire chunk of the chromosome sweeps through the population so quickly, it wipes out the normal background genetic diversity you would normally expect to see in that neighborhood.
Oh, that makes sense.
Right. So Tajima's D and NSL are statistical algorithms that detect that suspicious lack of diversity. They scan the genome looking for regions where everyone suddenly has the exact same sequence, which proves that natural selection recently acted on that specific spot.
And what did these tests reveal about the NPIP genes?
The results prove that positive selection acting on the NPIP genes isn't just a relic of the ancient evolutionary past. It is ongoing in the human population right now.
Right now?
Yes. Specific paralogs, notably MPIP-MEI9 and B15, show some of the most extreme signals of positive selection across the entirety of chromosome 16. Evolution is actively, aggressively favoring these specific gene copies today.
But I have a hard time accepting the math of that evolutionary trade-off. We established at the very beginning that the instability of chromosome 16 causes devastating conditions like autism, developmental delay, and severe schizophrenia.
Right.
These are conditions that can severely impact an individual's ability to survive or reproduce. How can any cognitive or reproductive benefit outweigh a penalty that steep? Nature does not normally tolerate that level of biological cost.
That is the crux of the paradox, honestly. And it forces us to look at population genetics rather than individual fitness. The math only balances if the adaptive function of these genes provides an overwhelming advantage to the species as a whole.
Right.
Given their high expression in the brain and testes, the benefit of cognitive expansion, advanced neural networking, or reproductive success, it must mathematically outweigh the genetic casualties caused by the structural instability. We are basically paying a steep biological tax to maintain whatever advantage these genes provide.
It is a ruthless calculus. But as amazing as this long-read study is, there are still pieces of the puzzle missing, aren't there? The researchers have the DNA blueprints, and they have the RNA transcripts proving the factory is running. But what are the limitations here? What don't we know?
The primary limitation is that we lack the comprehensive proteomic data. We know the cell is receiving the RNA work orders, but we need advanced mass spectrometry to isolate and analyze the physical proteins themselves.
So we know the factory is churning out these novel proteins, but we haven't quite managed to catch the delivery trucks leaving the loading dock to see exactly where they go.
Right.
Or, you know, what other molecules they interact with inside the cell.
That is the necessary next step. Until a scientific community maps the proteome of these newly resurrected hypervariable genes, we really won't know the exact biochemical role they play in human cognition or reproduction.
It is just an incredible biological detective story. Let's bring this all together for you, our listener, so you have a clear picture of what we've discovered today in this deep dive. The NPIP gene family is an exceptionally dynamic, highly duplicated region of the human genome that was previously hidden from science because our older short-read sequencing tools simply couldn't decipher its complexity.
But thanks to the revolutionary clarity of long-read sequencing, the fog has finally lifted. We now know this region harbors unique, human-specific innovations, like novel brain and tests proteins that are under intense ongoing positive selection.
It reveals a fascinating evolutionary trade-off between dangerous genomic instability, the kind that leads to severe neurodevelopmental disease, and the adaptive neofunctionalization that helped build the human brain. What does this mean for our understanding of the dark matter of our genome and the dangerous genetic gambles that made us uniquely human?
It's exactly the question we have to keep asking.
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science, base by base.
Flicker like a storming cold. Letters drown where the clean line should unfold. I chase a signal through a stack.